Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on today's show, Aging in America, a look back at the Freedom Rides. And WNYC's Brooke Gladstone will join me with her new book. But up first, the U.S. Supreme Court's term is drawing to a close, and here to join me with a look at the term that almost ends, but not quite yet, is one of the foremost experts on the U.S. Supreme Court, Dahlia Lithwick with Slate.com. Dahlia, good morning. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having me, Jamie.
Well, let's start with the two big First Amendment cases, and these are two that actually drew a lot of national attention in a term that perhaps deserved even more than it got, and that, of course, is the Phelps funeral case and the violent video games case. First, let's talk about Phelps. That case maybe got more attention than any other case this term. Pastor Phelps, of course, leading the radical ministry that makes it a point to protest at funerals of fallen soldiers, and Matthew Snyder's father filed the suit alleging, among other things, infliction of emotional distress. How did the court come down in that case?
Well, this was, you know, you're exactly right. I think this term, you know, not a lot of blockbusters, but this was the case that became the blockbuster. I don't think because of really controversial speech issues, but because the facts of this case are just so awful. You know, you have this Westboro Baptist Church that believes that America is on the wrong track because we condone homosexual behavior, and the way America is being punished is, I fail to get the connection, but soldiers die abroad. And so they protest funerals of people who are private citizens in their most grief-filled moments. And as you said, the Snyder family, trying to bury their son Matthew in Maryland, is met with awful, awful signs that say things like "God hates fags" and "Thank God for dead soldiers." And there's no dispute in this case that there is lasting harm to Albert Snyder, the father of Matthew Snyder. There's no dispute that he, you know, is emotionally damaged. And so the case becomes this very, very tough question about, is this nevertheless, despite the harms inflicted, protected free speech? And 8-1, with one dissenter is Samuel Alito, the court says absolutely this is protected free speech. As odious and awful as this is, even though this is a private funeral and a private party, this is core political speech. Chief Justice John Roberts more or less writes, you know, if we can't protect this kind of political speech, we can't protect anything. Sam Alito, and I should add here that he was the dissenter in last year's big free speech case, and that had to do with animal cruelty videos. So again, the lone dissenter, Sam Alito, says, in effect, this isn't speech at all. This is assault. And how can we even call this speech? And so it really does generate unbelievable backlash around the country from people who think there has to be a limit, there has to be a line between when even core political speech becomes an attack on a private family.
As you say, an 8-1 decision that really seemed to crystallize the free speech issue. The other big First Amendment case, really known to the public only as the violent video games case, one of those cases where we imagine the justices sitting in a private screening room watching all kinds of objectionable material to determine whether it's entitled to constitutional protection. What was the issue in that case?
That is a California ban that was enacted that attempted to ban videos, violent video games for children, for minors. And again, it comes up as a free speech challenge because the question is, how is this any different from violent movies? How is this any different from comic books? The argument becomes, and this is not just the video game industry, but you know, amicus briefs by all sorts of different folks in the entertainment industry saying, come on, California is just freaking out about new technology, and that at every turn in American history, when a new form of technology comes out, there is the argument that this one is going to destroy children forever and make them violent and crazy. One of the amicus briefs that was really interesting in this case made the point that they made the same arguments right across the street on Capitol Hill when comic books came out, and they said Superman is going to brain damage our children. The other side of this case says, no, video games are different. This is not passively consuming media. This is, and Justice, in this case, it's Chief Justice John Roberts, who has small children, by the way, and maybe is more sensitive to this than the other justices, really describes graphically games in which children are ripping the heads off other characters and, you know, urinating on them and leaving them on the train tracks to die, and essentially saying not only is this way beyond the bounds of civility for our children, but Roberts is the one who says, you know, parents work. We can't supervise what our children are doing. We can't say that, you know, leave this to the parents. And I think also some pretty good data comes out of this case where there is some credible evidence being put forward by the state of California that there is a connection between children who play hours and hours of these games and subsequent violent behavior. So again, this looks like a crisp, easy free speech case. This seems to be just clearly speech that is protected. But I think that there is interwoven in this case are real questions about whether technology changes all that.
Yeah, and that case was an interesting mix of law, parenting, and geekiness when you added the technology in the mix. Let's talk law and criminal law in particular and procedure. Just Monday, a pretty big decision on that. And with all the other news, it didn't get a whole lot of attention, certainly not as much as the Phelps funeral case or even the violent video games case. And that's Kentucky versus King. It looks like the court took a pretty big slice out of the Fourth Amendment. And just to remind folks who are listening, the Fourth Amendment is that part of the Constitution that protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. And that means of the home or of the person without a warrant. What was the case? What was the ruling? It starts simply enough, isn't it? Just the controlled. Well, why don't you give us the facts? I don't want to steal your thunder, but it's a pretty big deal, isn't it? Or am I overreading?
No, it's a huge deal, and I think you're quite right. If we hadn't had quite so many sex scandals, this might have gotten more attention. But it's very much of a piece, Jamie, with a long trend that we've seen at the court of just chipping away at the warrant requirement and the probable cause requirement for the Fourth Amendment. And so what's shocking about this case, I'll describe the facts in a second, but what's really shocking is this comes down 8-1 in favor of the police. So it's not simply that it's further eroding the warrant requirement, it's that somehow this was a slam dunk for the court. The facts of the case are kind of comic but tragic, and in effect what happens is that the police are chasing a suspect that they have seen in a drug deal with an informant. They chase him into an apartment complex, and then they lose him. And so they can't figure out quite which apartment he ran into, but they smell marijuana coming from under the door of an apartment. Well, ordinarily, the Fourth Amendment demands that they either get a warrant, stop what they're doing and go get a warrant from a neutral magistrate, or if there is some class of what we call exigent circumstances, they're still allowed to enter. Exigent circumstances are things like someone's screaming, someone comes running out with a crack pipe in their hand, you know, something that leads them to believe that evidence in there is going to be destroyed if they take the time to go get a warrant. In this case, there's no exigent circumstances except the fact that the cops start pounding on the door yelling, police, police, police. So in effect, what they do is they hear shuffling inside the apartment and they think, hey, someone's destroying the evidence in there. But they've created the exigency. By pounding on the door and shouting, police, police, police. They've led to what they say now is, oh, you know, there was shuffling and maybe toilet flushing and some reason to believe that evidence was was being destroyed. And the Kentucky court said, no, you can't have exigent circumstances or emergency non-warrant circumstances when the police themselves create it. These guys wouldn't have been destroying their drugs if they didn't have the police pounding on their door. And so the police had time to go get a warrant. The Supreme Court, 8-1, in an opinion written by Justice Sam Alito, says, nope. This is a permissible search. And what it means going forward, you know, it seems like a one-time only thing, but it's in fact a very big deal. Ruth Bader Ginsburg writes a very, very strong dissent saying, you have just given the police an amazing, amazing tool to get around the need for a warrant. If they just smell pot and they hear a little shuffling, all they need to do is bang on the door, and they've created an exigent circumstance. There's a weirdness in this case that I should flag, which is that both at oral argument and in the opinion, there seems to be assumption on the part of the majority that, well, they could have just not opened the door, or they could have just told the cops to go away. And it strikes me as such a strange framing of an issue, because we all know that if the cops are pounding on your door shouting police, 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 you're very, very unlikely to tell them to just go away. You're going to let them in and you're going to get arrested. So this really is an end run around the warrant requirement, not because of any emergency, but simply because the cops create the emergency themselves.
And before Kentucky versus King, there was what some would think of as a bit of a companion case, Connick versus Thompson. It's more criminal law than criminal procedure. I think it can be characterized as a Sixth Amendment case. It did get national attention. It generated a lot of outrage in the blogosphere. It's got the famous Connick name attached to the case, Harry Connick Sr. He was for 40 years the sheriff in New Orleans. Tell us, though, who Mr. Thompson was.
Mr. Thompson was on death row for many, many years for a murder he did not commit. There was clear impermissible behavior on the behalf of the DA's office in investigating this case. And then, and this is the nut of the case, there's an obligation on behalf of prosecutors to turn over what's called Brady material, exculpatory material, to the defense. They had very, very clear evidence that someone else's blood was in their possession, that it was not Mr. Thompson. Certainly a defense lawyer would have wanted something and made great hay with that. It simply wasn't turned over. So the case becomes a challenge because it turns out that Harry Connick Sr. has just utterly failed to train his prosecutors in what to do with this Brady material, that there is an obligation to turn over exculpatory material. And he just has admitted on the stand and in earlier iterations of this case that, yeah, I stopped reading the books years ago, and I don't really, you know, feel that I needed to train these guys. And so it literally comes up. Now, Mr. Thompson has had four or five different execution dates scheduled. He's got a private investigator comes into the case at the very last minute and discovers this material that had never been turned over and sues the DA's office and says, we want to be compensated for decades on death row and for the fact that you simply didn't train your prosecutors, that it was their obligation to turn this over at trial. And at every level of this case, he prevails and he wins a jury verdict, and then the appeals courts agree. But the Supreme Court says no. The Supreme Court says no, we can't hold the head of the district attorney's office responsible for the misconduct of his underlings. And so this settlement is washed away, and Thompson, while free to walk away, doesn't get any money from this. And one of the reasons it really did become one of the signal cases of the term was that Clarence Thomas, writing for the court, not only overturned the views of every other person who had looked at this case and said, of course this is unconscionable to not train your prosecutors to turn over this material, but a certain lack of compassion, a certain indifference to Mr. Thompson's suffering, a real sense that, well, you know, prosecutors make mistakes, but they're doing their best, and we can't put them on the hook for this. And I think a lot of folks who read that opinion came away thinking that this was just someone who, by a narrow, narrow margin, escaped being executed for a crime he did not commit. And the court, or at least the majority of this court in the case, seemed not to care at all.
And those who are further interested in the Connick versus Thompson decision can read your piece on that specific point at Slate.com. Dahlia, I can't let you go without asking you about your current piece on Slate, and it is actually a good concluding question. The current piece is called Judicial Review Under Review, but the subtitle is perhaps as instructive. The subtitle is, Should the Legal Arguments Over Obama's Health Care Law Force Us to Reconsider the Role of the Courts? So, Dahlia, I won't ask what your conclusion is. For that, people should read the piece, but it's a good question. And what made you ask the question?
Well, I'm being accused of having an existential crisis, Jamie, having covered the courts for 12 years. But there is something about these ACA challenges and the judicial opinion writing that goes with it that is kind of stunning every single judge who has put their hands on this case. And there are, 20-some cases in the lower courts, 3 cases going up to the courts of appeals this summer. Every judge who touches this votes absolutely corresponding to the president who appointed him. And so every Republican who has looked at this case so far has said it's unconstitutional, strike it down. Every Democrat who has looked at this case has said, hey, this is a great law. It's completely within congressional power to regulate interstate commerce. And so I have never in my life witnessed a starker example of judicial ideology driving results. And it's just leads one to wonder if we are doing something horribly wrong in this country when judges are really almost unable to disaggregate their politics from their law.
All right. Well, I commend your piece to our listeners. Again, it's called Judicial Review Under Review. Our guest is Dahlia Lithwick, Slate.com. Dahlia, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure.
And coming up next, what it means to get older in a youth-obsessed culture. I am Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer.